You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Knetter, in today for Rob Ferret. Coming up, a small, dead-end Wisconsin town is the setting for a new novel by UW-Whitewater professor Ken Broski. We're talking about what inspired the writing and what encouragement he has for us to develop our own writing style. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with an update on the life of a Cuban Wisconsinite who lives in La Crosse. He's featured on the podcast WPR Reports, Uprooted.
Ernesto Rodriguez came to Wisconsin in the summer of 1980. That's after making a treacherous journey on a fishing boat from Cuba to the United States. Quickly after arriving on shore, Erne was shipped off to Fort McCoy in Sparta, Wisconsin. And it's in the military base's kitchen that he got a crash course in American food from a local cook.
One day he said, "Are you guys like macaroni and cheese? What the hell is macaroni and cheese?"
Erne has come to love mac and cheese and burgers. But as he first told us in the podcast, WPR Reports Uprooted, he also still cooks traditional Cuban food like congri and chicken fricasse. Erne has embraced life in Wisconsin, but has never let go of his Cuban roots. He's lived between two worlds, only able to walk in one of them, the U.S. He's dreamed of returning to Cuba for a visit.
Well, the first thing I'm going to do is go to my hometown, see if I recognize where I used to live, and then spend the time with my family in Florida.
Erne has been a permanent resident of the U.S. for decades, but he wasn't able to become a citizen due to paperwork issues with his Cuban birth certificate. That means he couldn't vote or get a U.S. passport to travel. That is, until fall 2023. Ernesto Rodriguez traveled to Minnesota, where he took part in a naturalization ceremony.
All right, if everybody can please raise your right hand, and you're going to repeat after me. I hereby declare...
After reciting the Pledge of Allegiance, Erne received his certificate of naturalization. He was beaming.
Yeah, American citizen. I'm happy. I'm excited. You know, it's big, big stuff.
He waited more than 40 years for this moment.
I feel released now because now I can vote. Now I can apply to be like La Crosse mayor.
He may be joking about running for mayor, but he's very serious about getting to vote. Erne grew up in Cuba and has only just become a U.S. citizen. He's in his mid-60s, and he's never voted in an election.
In 40 years I've been here, I have a sixth president, Jimmy Carter, Reagan, Bush.
He keeps up with politics in the news, so this is a huge deal to finally be able to participate in the democratic process. As for Erne's other lifelong dream, going back to visit Cuba, now that he can actually do it, he has some mixed feelings.
The only way I can go to Cuba is the whole government thing is throw away, throw to the garbage. If Cuba be free, then I can go there.
Erne is wary of the Cuban government. He misses his family, but even his sister discourages him from visiting. It's partially because he's been speaking out against the government and communism.
Cuba, you say, I don't like Castro, and there's people watching you, and they put you in prison for no reason.
Standing proudly next to Erne is Michelle Pinzel. They've been close friends for nearly two decades, so this day is emotional for her, too.
It's just incredible to see how patient and how diligent Ernesto has been in all of these years.
While Erne waits to vote and thinks about visiting Cuba, he has other things he wants to tackle first as a citizen.
Enjoying my life in a great country, America. Work to prove my life a little more and maybe buy a house and be a comedy, you know, stand comedy, make a joke.
But before he launches his stand-up comedy career, Erne is taking the day to celebrate. His first stop, lunch at a Cuban restaurant in the Twin Cities. His second stop, the Mall of America, so he can find a shirt or hat that features the U.S. and Cuban flags. To learn more about Erne's life in Cuba and Wisconsin, check out the podcast WPR Reports Uprooted at wpr.org/uprooted. Big thanks to Mark Rickers for recording the audio for this story in Minneapolis. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, there's a lot that can go wrong when we think we know what's best for other people. Hubris is at the heart of a new horror novel from our next guest, a Wisconsin writer and professor, and he wanted to explore taking that idea to an extreme and supernatural level. We're going to talk about some of the themes from his new book and where he's drawing inspiration, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think small towns lend themselves to settings in works of fiction? Is it a setting that you like when you find it in a book? And are you a horror fiction fan? What do you like about reading books from that genre? What are some of your favorites? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Ken Broski is an associate professor of English at UW-Whitewater. His latest novel is called What Doesn't Kill You. Ken, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. I'm a big fan.
Oh, thanks. And you are a member of the Horror Writers Association. You contribute regularly to genre publications. What do you like so much about reading and writing in the horror genre?
I like to be scared. That's one of the first things for sure that always sticks out with me. And I think also, I think we're sort of, this has been written about a couple of times recently, but we're definitely in sort of like a golden age of horror literature. There's so many different ways of writing it that authors are exploring, and they're coming up with some really interesting stuff. I tend to be more of like a classic horror writer compared to my contemporaries, but for me especially, this idea that horror can stand in for other things, I think makes it a really interesting avenue to explore. And also, I like monsters, so that's always a plus too.
Monsters are fun, yeah. What do you think makes for a really good fictional horror work, whether it's a short story or a novel? What makes for good, scary fiction?
You know, I think, you know, and I tell my students this a lot, I think the starting point really needs to be making sure that the writer knows about the conventions of horror so that they don't end up writing something that feels very generic or falls into a lot of tropes and cliches. I think once you know those elements of horror, I think you can really go above and beyond what people normally think of as horror. There's a lot of writers right now who like to write scary stories that involve how the body changes, for example. And that's always like a really interesting concept to explore from a horror perspective, because, I mean, let's face it, adolescence can be pretty horrific when you don't know what's going on with your body. And so there's a lot of writers exploring that. But I think for me especially, I start by thinking about what is scary, and then moving beyond that into thinking about, well, what scares the people that I want to write about?
Sure. And your latest writing is the book, What Doesn't Kill You. I want to turn to that and talk about, first off, the setting. It is the fictional Wisconsin town of Seven Sisters, Wisconsin. Can you talk to us a little bit about what it's like there in Seven Sisters?
So Seven Sisters is this classic small town that has sort of lost its luster as the result of a new road project that went in. And so it sort of went overnight from being right on this major highway route to sort of being like just a side road of a major highway route that moved. So it's got, you know, it has this one place of employment, which is the local grain depository. And then, you know, beyond that, it really is this town that's sort of just fallen into disrepair as the result of, the economic imbalance that occurs when a town basically has this meaningful economic shift. And so it's a really great location for a scary story, because what ultimately happens in the book very early on is that the town essentially gets snowed in during this pretty heavy blizzard. And because the town is, everybody who lives in the town is so close to one another, it almost feels like, as I was imagining it in my head, it almost felt like the sort of like closed Hollywood set And so I could picture, I actually drew the entire town on a piece of paper just to keep my head straight. And it was so easy to picture because it was basically this one main road that used to be a highway. And on one side of the road, you've got this grain mill located next to a railroad track. You've got a bar, you've got a little sort of all-purpose general store. And then on the other side of the old highway, you've got this horseshoe-shaped road where all the houses are on. And so as I was sort of like imagining the things happening in the story, I could always go back to that picture. And I was always reminded of, like, you know, just how isolated some small towns have become, especially if those towns are off the beaten path.
We're talking with Ken Broski right now, Associate Professor of English at UW-Whitewater and author of the new horror novel, What Doesn't Kill You. We're taking your calls, too, at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest? Have you started writing some fiction of your own? How's it going? What's working? What isn't? And do you have a favorite horror novel you want to share? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter. We continue our talk with Ken Broski, professor of English at UW-Whitewater. We're talking about his new horror novel, What Doesn't Kill You, set in a small fictional Wisconsin town. And Ken, I got to say, I think you nailed the small Wisconsin town setting. Having grown up in one myself, a lot of the details were ringing true. Things I've heard people say, observations I've seen people make. I also loved the energy, because chapter by chapter, you're bouncing around to different places and different people, but they all kind of know each other, which I think makes it feel a little more intimate. How does that everybody knows everything aspect, how did that figure into the storytelling here?
You know, it's funny. None of that really came in the first draft of the story. I think in the first draft of the story, I was really just trying to get, I knew I wanted this monster to exist in the story. I knew kind of why I wanted all of that stuff to happen. And then as I was sort of going through the revision process, I'm one of those writers who spends a lot of time going back and rereading and then making changes and then going back and making changes. And so for me, like layering that town history and trying to get a sense of how each person would know the other people in the town was really useful, actually. And it didn't come all at once. It sort of was this process. I was really inspired by, I went back and rewatched a TV miniseries called Storm of the Century, based on a screenplay by Stephen King. And the TV show is kind of funny because it doesn't really... It's kind of goofy sometimes, but at the same time, it was also like a really good examination of a small town living under duress. And so those kinds of stories helped give me a sense of just how much these characters needed to know about each other. And so as I was building it out, you know, piece by piece, family by family, it actually got easier as I was doing it because I started to know the characters better, and I started to know exactly what they would do in that situation. So that was my approach with the town as a whole.
And why did you want to explore hubris as a main theme in this horror story?
I had this idea. I had seen this picture of this statue, and there was a beehive that had been, you know, bees had built this beehive on the statue's head. And I was like, wow, this is a really scary image. And then I didn't think of it for a while. And then I had a horrible nightmare about this beehive statue chasing me, which, you know, I woke up and I was like, wow, that was really scary. I should write something about that. So that was kind of like the start. But then as I was sort of thinking about, like, well, why do I want this to exist in this small town? I started to pay more careful attention to social media in general. And one of the things that has started to like really stand out, the more I've been reading about social media, like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and TikTok, is that the people who create those programs that get us addicted, they always think about what's best, what they think is what's best for us, right? They think they know what we want. They think they know what we will like. And that's why those algorithms sort of get us addicted to social media so easily, is because they've essentially designed this process for telling us what we want and, you know, thinking about what they know best about us is more important than what we think we know best. And so I took that idea and I sort of implemented in this small town setting. And then I threw in a scary monster because, you know, I mean, it's a horror novel. It's got to have a scary monster in it. And I don't know. I constantly think about that a lot, this idea that if we are, you know, if we're going to spend so much of our time on social media and the people running it always are making decisions because they think they know what's best for us, what kind of world does that create?
We're talking with Ken Broski, Associate Professor of English at UW-Whitewater, author of the new book, What Doesn't Kill You. Ken, I also wanted to get your thoughts on some writing inspiration for us. And with that in mind, I want to go to the phones right now. We have Jim with us in Juneau. Hi, Jim.
Hello. Thanks for taking the call.
You bet. Yeah, what do you want to bring up?
Well, first, there's actually two things. I've had this book in my head since I was a little kid, and I'm in my 50s now. So I wanted to know what kind of advice you could give for the getting off my ass, sorry, and just putting pen to paper. How do you go about doing that for yourself? Second, I would like to know, mine also is based on kind of a science fiction-ish topic. And so how do you keep from falling too much into that niche? How can you make it relatable?
Gotcha. Jim, thanks for the questions. Sure. What do you think, Ken?
So, Jim, I'll give you a couple of ideas as a starting point. I think one thing you probably want to start with is thinking about the inciting incident. In other words, you know, take your main character and before you write anything, jot down what a normal day in the life of your main character looks like. And then think about what is the inciting incident that is going to get, that is going to change your main character's life. And once you have that inciting incident, you can sort of leap into the story you want to write. I think one of the best things to start with when it comes to like how to figure out how to tell the story is remember the three magic words of storytelling. And the three magic words are therefore, however, and meanwhile. Okay. And therefore is one of the most important words because everything in your story, whatever you decide to tell in your story, should have purpose. There should be a reason it's being told. And so that's why in a lot of stories you see writers skip entire days. That's why in some stories you see, you know, writers will fast forward an hour or they might say something like the main character had dinner and then went out, right? And they don't mention the dinner itself because it's not important to the story, right? So the word therefore is really important because it'll keep your mind focused on what's important in the story itself. And then however is where you throw a wrench in the gears of whatever's happening. So anytime you want to ramp up the tension, you use the word however as sort of like that key word in your head that tells you that something unexpected needs to happen to your main character and they need to react to that. And then you need to think about how that affects the story, right? So for example, if you watch the original Star Wars, you have the two droids who land on Tatooine at the beginning of the original Star Wars. The however for them was getting caught by the Jawas and then getting sold to Luke Skywalker. And then, of course, Luke Skywalker deciding he doesn't want to go with Obi-Wan Kenobi. However, when he returns home, his aunt and uncle have been killed by the Empire, right? So that word becomes super meaningful. And then the word meanwhile, you can use to jump from chapter to chapter. Meanwhile is kind of like this opportunity for you to cut to a new scene in your head as you're telling this story. With sci-fi, this is especially important because readers don't need to get bogged down with the world building too much with sci-fi. They want to jump right into the story. So think about your main character's life. what is going to throw them out of balance? What is going to be that inciting incident, and how do they react to it?
Jim, thanks for the call. And Ken, thanks for that advice. We love to ask authors when they're on with us what they are reading. A little bit of a lightning round right now for you. Let's start with the horror genre. What's your recommendation right now for readers to pick up?
Oh, man. Well, I mean, you got to read What Doesn't Kill You, because I got to sell some books. Yeah, or my publisher is going to break my thumbs. But in terms of horror, I read another really good book called Boys in the Valley. It's by an author named Philip Fracassi. And it's kind of like the best way to describe it is Lord of the Flies meets The Exorcist. And so that's my horror recommendation beyond, and of course, my book, obviously. But I got some other ones. Should we do some other genres too?
We've just got about 1 minute left. How about mystery?
Okay, mystery. I would say definitely read Blacktop Wasteland by S.A. Cosby. He's a fantastic author. It's one of the best mysteries I've read in a long time. And if you have Audible or if you have a Libby subscription, definitely pick up the audio version because the narrator is fantastic.
And real quick, an all-time book recommendation.
I would say definitely Cloud Atlas by David Mitchell. It's one of my favorite books. It takes a little bit of extra effort to follow. But once you get the hang of it, I think you'll be in for just an amazing fantasy, sci-fi, mystery, humor. It's got everything. It's my favorite book of all time.
Ken, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Ken Broski is an associate professor of English at UW-Whitewater and author of the new novel, What Doesn't Kill You?